This is Mae Bressel. The broadcast is World Watchers. It's a one-hour broadcast of news, investigation of news, in case you are late in turning this program in. Some people are. It's on every week. It's broadcast number 708, and it's July the 1st, 1985. The Los Angeles Herald, June the 30th, just yesterday, had an article by Rabbi Abraham Cooper, one of the West Coast representatives for the Simon Wiesenthal Center, along with Rabbi Heyer. Heyer is a good name. It's spelled H-E-I-R. You can change it around the other way if you want. Article's titled, After Mengele, Where Now for the Hunters and the Hunted? And in this article, he says, there's no doubt that over the years, due largely to the lonely efforts of Simon Wiesenthal in Vienna, Joseph Mengele came to symbolize the arch criminal throughout the civilized world, that he was going to find and pull in the arch criminal of the civilized world. Rabbi Abraham Cooper, incidentally, is associate dean of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. That's his official title. And I could say that in 1984-85, Wiesenthal was hardly looking for Mengele until the push came on in February when the drug connections came in, and I was needling them, sending information through various people and calls about the Barbie and DeLorean connections for a long time, 2 years, and the American citizenship papers, of course, that's been just a closed door with them all along, but they never stopped giving themselves accolades, and the news gives them an entire half page of the story. Now, in apropos of the Mengele story, the way the Wiesenthal Center works now and the way they've swung, if I want to interpret the trading of a certain, I won't be nasty about it. You come to your own conclusions. Here's the Los Angeles Herald. I won't come out and say it. Here's the Los Angeles Herald. Wiesenthal is asking for Alois Brunner, B-R-U-N-N-E-R, Adolf Eichmann's top aide in Madrid. Why would he want Adolf Eichmann's aide in Madrid when Otto von Bolschwing, with the links to the Getty family, to Ford Philco, to the Defense Department, for Stanford Research, to the corporations in California, the aerospace, to Warner Lambert, to Helene von Damm, our ambassador, to Vienna, who just resigned recently, why would Mr. Brunner be more important to anybody than a man who had the strength and power to promote? A man, Richard Nixon, and his contacts through Warner Lambert put the presidency in the hands of Richard Nixon, a long ally to the German Nazis, and make sure that John Kennedy, if he won the election, wouldn't survive and Nixon would be their president. Why is Brunner more important than Otto von Bolschwing was in the United States and California in terms of worldwide Odessa network with the contacts he had in every country in South America, the trips to Argentina, and working for the Cabot family from New England, and working for Cabot Coal? Why is Brunner more important? He also mentions Leon Degrelle, D-E-G-R-E-L-L-E-S, Belgium's foremost fascist and German collaborator who keeps preaching the virtues of the SS. Well, if he doesn't like the virtues of the SS, why accept a medal from Helmut Kohl, who's going to the graves of the SS and be photographed surrounded by the graves of the SS? What's the difference? But then the article goes on, the Herald, and it says the magnitude of theirs and other crimes and the overwhelming apathy toward their almost guaranteed freedom tend to underscore the chilling validity of statement attributed to Joseph Stalin. Now, this is Rabbi Abraham Cooper saying that the magnitude of their crimes is similar to what Joseph Stalin said in quotes, "One death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic." That's Rabbi Abraham Cooper from the Wiesenthal Center. That's June the 30th, 1985. Now, April the 1st, 1979, Section H3, Simon Wiesenthal was being interviewed. This is 79, about 2 weeks after the alleged Mengele bones are going to, the lie that Mengele died at the beach through the Bossert's and the Stammert's and Mr. Romeo Tuma, who deals directly with Wiesenthal later, and I'll get to that, in the deals they made. That's why it's so important. April the 1st, 1979, just weeks after this alleged death of the Nazi war criminal Joseph Mengele. He has an interview in the Washington Post, and he's talking about the case of Anne Frank, because there were demonstrations when the play came out in 1958, the Austrian youth saying it was all a lie. And so Simon Wiesenthal was able to produce the policeman, Mr. Silberbauer, S-I-L-B-E-R-B-A-U-E-R, who at that time was an Austrian police officer in 1978, even though he had been in Holland ordering the death of the Frank family earlier. And then he goes on to Simon Wiesenthal, the Anne Frank case must not be discredited because in terms of its impact on people, it is more important than the Nuremberg trial, Wiesenthal said. In Adolf Eichmann's memoirs, according to Wiesenthal, Eichmann says this, 100 deaths is a catastrophe, 1 million is a statistic. So in 1979, he was quoting his enemy, Adolf Eichmann. In 1985, with his $100 million building that he wants and his $20 million in Beverly Hills and all of his honors, it changes all of a sudden. It isn't Eichmann the enemy anymore. It's Joseph Stalin and the Russians. He's surrounded by the Cold Warriors, the people that want World War III, the past links to the assassination of John Kennedy, the hidden links of John Kennedy's murder to Martin Bormann and Mengele's and that South American connection. The Bormann connection I wrote up in The Rebel in 1983. So all of a sudden, the Wiesenthal Center is quoting Joseph Stalin as your enemy because it pays to be against Russia. And it doesn't. You wouldn't get as much bread if you stuck to Eichmann. So the source changed in these years. And just the week after the admission, the forced admission, the voluntary admission, the lying admission, whatever it was on his part, that Joseph Mengele was in fact dead, now they're using the quotation of Stalin and not of Adolf Eichmann. In the book The Murderers Among Us, printed in 1967, the Simon Wiesenthal Memoirs, the profile is written by Joseph Weschberg, W-E-C-H-S-B-E-R-G, who says that he also was in the OSS with Simon Wiesenthal. There's a time section, page 28 to 29, where Simon Wiesenthal's living conditions in September 42 seem to be, as you all know, that he survived. Early in 1942, when Gestapo chief Reinhard Heydrich was murdered in early 42, the Jews were rounded up for a wave of terror that leveled towns, and Wiesenthal family were killed. His mother, members of his family, he never saw her again. His wife's mother was killed. But he somehow, and we'll go into that in detail, escaped these 12 concentration camps where he'd be lining up with 43 men, 44 people. Then they'd pull Wiesenthal out and all 43 would be gunned down. Wiesenthal was the survivor of 12 camps to go arm in arm with Prince Radziwill. But in September 42, on page 28, it jumps from 42 to April 43, which is 9 months, and it doesn't tell you how he's surviving in a camp when all the Jews are really ordered to be slaughtered. And after Heydrich's murder, Hitler really has no more nice guys, and they're going to start roughing up that final solution. It doesn't explain what he did. It's a paperback, and 2 pages, you already jump 9 months. Time enough to have a baby. But on April the 20th, Adolf Hitler's birthday, it tells how he's going to round up the people from the Gestapo SS who run the camps, are going to round up people to murder because it is Hitler's birthday and they want to have a party. And it describes here April the 20th, 1943. Hitler's 54th birthday was sunny, a touch of spring in the air. Wiesenthal had been up since dawn painting Hitler posters and swastikas for the big SS celebration at the repair works at the railroad. Right. He and his 2 Jewish helpers were finishing a big sign, "We love you, our Führer. We lieben unseren Führer. We love our Führer." And then it tells how he was rounded up with all these other people. 38 were shot, put in the sand pits. He survives, and I'll go into the names who helped him. But what rubbed off on him, I know if you didn't take a certain job, that you would be killed. But he was an engineer and a draftsman, an architect, And he's busy painting We Love You, Fuhrer, and Swastikas. And I read this in other articles also. And somehow he is able to get out of all the death traps that everyone around him went into and come out a survivor, working for the CIC, the Counterintelligence Corps, the OSS, when it was so filled with Nazis and fascists and people like Henry Simpson, who was warning about letting Jews have any decisions because they would be vengeful after the war, and the anti-Semitism of John J. McCloy and Alan Dulles and William Donovan and the OSS team. It's interesting that Simon Wiesenthal, the painter of the swastikas for quite a long time at that particular railroad yard, comes out okay. Now, on page 40 to 41, it tells about his being at Buchenwald, and people from Buchenwald arrived at the railroad station at Mauthausen, Mauthausen. That is the concentration camp where he was when the Americans came and liberated it. There were 3,000 people that left Buchenwald, and 1,000 were alive at the time they got to the Mauthausen concentration camp. And it goes on, Wiesenthal remembers a terribly cold day when they were there, a clear night, with the grating sound of frozen snow under feet, and each step was a major effort. He happened to be walking next to a Prince Radziwill, one of whose relatives later married the sister of Mrs. John F. Kennedy. Their arms were linked, and they tried to support each other, but at last they couldn't go, and they fell asleep in the snow, and then there were shots around them, and they regained their consciousness, and the rest is history. They went off into the wild blue yonder, and Radziwill ends up, a little sample of Radziwill is from the book The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, as I mentioned earlier, by Joseph Borkin. And on pages 220, 221, 213, you can look up in the index, it is indexed, and look at the role of Prince Radziwill in trying to hold together the branches of I.G. Farben that were going to be separated, and how Robert Kennedy intervened for his brother-in-law. Brother-in-law wasn't only to be the brother of Jacqueline Onassis. The Bouvier family was very important in France, and as I say, Radziwill was important as the social scene and the fascists and the Nazis he mingled with after the war. So that in this book on The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, it tells about the intervention of Joe Kennedy, a Knight of Malta, along with William Casey and William Donovan and James Angleton, the Vatican's warriors and close links to the Vatican, the intervention of Robert Kennedy for his father, and the role they played for Prince Radziwill, and the appointment that Robert Kennedy made in the Justice Department to make sure that I.G. Farben didn't have to split off any of its particular holdings. A very interesting connection. What in the heck Radziwill was doing in that camp at that particular time? Who can guess on that one? Now, there were some articles going back to Wiesenthal in a second, but apropos of him, not everybody accepts the fact that Wiesenthal's conclusion, 99.9% Mengele is dead, is accurate. The Minneapolis Star Tribune has an interview sent to me by a listener in Minneapolis. It has a picture of my friend Brian Richard Boland and his press conference. It says, historian doubts the body in Brazil is Mengele. Minneapolis author and Nazi historian Brian Boland said he once met Joseph Mengele in Argentina. Now, this particular person, I've mentioned him on the air many times, has been one of my sources for a long, long time on Joseph Mengele, and everything they had given me or continue seems to fit into the Mengele that they knew. He and Charles, and that I have gone out and tried to tell to you in detail to you over and over again. He met him in Argentina. He strongly doubts that the remains exhumed last week in Brazil are those of the Nazi war criminal. This weekend, he said, the latest reports of the demise are part of a rather clumsy smokescreen to diffuse the intensity of the search for Mengele. Everything I've picked up from newspaper, television, and great radio clashes greatly with what I know about the man. I'm willing to adopt the let them prove it, it's him attitude. I believe he's alive and also beneficiary of an elaborate ruse which seems to be succeeding. Boland thinks the ruse is a diversionary tactic to help him flee Paraguay, where the author says the 74-year-old war criminal has been living. As a matter of fact, I quoted on a program, I think around February, that airplane that left Asunción, Paraguay, and went to La Paz, Bolivia. No, it was en route to there, and it never landed. And when they found it in the snow, the remnants, there were no bodies there. And I suggested as of February of this year that Mengele could have been on that plane. It was the day that Beat Clarsfield was to be arriving down in Paraguay for the first time, or maybe she's made many visits. And this plane took off and never went to La Paz. And interestingly enough, in the novel, he had to change it to a novel because his life was threatened. Brian wrote about a plane that left Asunción, Paraguay, and never got to La Paz, Bolivia. Now, one of the people said that Mengele likes to read stories about himself and these affairs, and sometimes the novel precedes the event, and in fact, the Central Intelligence Agency has a large section that simply takes novels, the ideas of the novelist, and makes them true. And I had this on World Watchers about that airplane with not a sight of a single body. In fact, there were several people from the Paraguayan embassy and no record of any funerals or remembrance services in this country, any person from the Peace Corps that was there. And I suggested that would be a way to leave, and they might have even tried to use the novel of Brian because he was familiar with Dieter Mengele and the nephews of Joseph Mengele and knows the family. The other possibility, I said, was that Mr. Giza Stammer, S-T-A-M-M-E-R, with his son, the captain in the Merchant Marine in Brazil, took a ship. They still haven't been photographed or seen. This has gone on now for almost a month. Next week it'll be a month. They were to go to Singapore and Japan, and the easiest thing would be for Mr. Strassner to deliver them from Paraguay right into Brazil. There's a town and border, many of them, that cross over, and put them on that boat and then send them to Southeast Asia or Japan, then fly them back to Switzerland or a convalarium or home in Europe or in Germany, and nobody is going to look for him now. He's officially dead. So he says that he thinks that this is a tactic to help him flee, and I thought of the two possibilities of fleeing, one in February and one this June. Boylan says Mengele has come, that they came to know as a lonely old man is not the type of that he knew at all, and he's familiar with the family. This is the Minneapolis Star and Tribune, June the 10th, 1985, page 4A. He's not the type of lonely old man that would be hidden away for years with an Austrian couple. Boland said his research and his meeting with Mengele in 1977 in Buenos Aires restaurant convinced him that such a fate would not be his style. He's a very gregarious man. He's not known to go hole up in a tiny town and live there for 10 years. He could use that hideaway attic they had, and I'll do more on that later. But sir, Brian didn't mention that. I just say there were places just to hide, but not for 10 years. He said he's a very deceptively cultured man. He likes music, opera, books. I found him fairly colorful in March 77 in Buenos Aires. We chatted about our favorite Wagner operas. Brian speaks fluent German. If I didn't know where he had been during World War II, I would have been impressed by his knowledge and charm. He said knowing who he was, it was revolting. Brian, 48, said he visited what he called the German restaurant in Buenos Aires. He was doing research on a book for Mengele. The man he met, he didn't introduce himself as Mengele, but he was told later, and that's the purpose, that he went there to see him, and it was confirmed that he had, in fact, met Mengele. It isn't in this article, but he gave the name to me of that Mr. von Oven, Goebbels' secretary, who arranged these meetings, and von Oven's name is mentioned in Ladislaus Farrago's book, Aftermath. Brian, who grew up in Chicago, has studied and researched Nazi war criminals since 1974. In 1983, he wrote Final Trace, the story about the Auschwitz survivor who spent his life tracking Nazi war criminals. At no time has interest in Mengele been as high as in the last 3 or 4 months. And I, this is from the Minneapolis paper, and I credit that to Brian and Charles for making the connections of William Hetrick or the allegations or the things to look into and following the bank accounts of Mengele. I think they finally were the ones that stirred up this interest. Boland said it really smells hokey. German authorities being unable to obtain vital statistics and fingerprints or tooth records struck me as very odd because I have documents showing the exact height, weight, and dental records, and he's holding them in the photograph. He got the dental records in 1975, along with a copy of Mengele's SS file from the Berlin Documentation Center. The dental records may not be apropos to a bunch of bones. I don't know if they can use them. They have only found three teeth. That is not enough to make identification. Then out of the New York Times on the 23rd of June, the Israeli government said today it was reserving its conclusion on the identification of Mengele. This is one day after Simon Wiesenthal is 99.9%. And before I get back to Wiesenthal now and for the next few weeks, I just want to interject a few of these articles. From Tel Aviv, international medical experts determined last week that the body was Joseph Mengele, but the Israelis have not yet withdrawn their offer made early this year of $1 million reward in bringing him to stand trial. The Ministry of Justice in Jerusalem published a statement clarifying its position. The Israelis had taken part in the investigation in Brazil. We do not cast doubts on the expertise of the pathologist, but at the same time, it continued, we will be able to determine our final conclusion only after receiving in Israel the scientific material that served as the basis for the pathologist's conclusions and considerable additional material which was recently discovered during the investigation. So that is coming out of Tel Aviv from the Israeli government, and their position as of June 24th was they would wait. The B'nai B'rith messenger in Los Angeles, June 28th, has a story from Jerusalem, doubts on Mengele's death. Former Nazi hunter Isser Harel, I-S-S-E-R-H-A-R-E-L, who was former head of the Mossad, was instrumental in the capture of Adolf Eichmann in 1961, insisted here that Mengele is still alive despite the conclusions of a report in Brazil and, of course, despite the conclusions of Simon Wiesenthal, who's 99.9% sure, okay? There was no official government response, but a Justice Ministry spokesman said Israel was waiting again. And this goes back to the report. The Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles said in a statement they agreed with reasonable scientific certainty that the remains are Joseph Mengele. And also they agreed that it was Joseph Stalin who made the quotations and not Adolf Eichmann. Just remember what they're mangling with history if you want to know how the Wiesenthal Center moves. Another story from Menachem Rosak, who went over to Brazil. This was on the 21st of June, and he was supposed to agree with the case. Israeli expert insists Joseph Mengele is alive, so it depends what you read. Mr. Rosak said he's not so sure. The Israeli police in Tel Aviv said they don't believe statements and documents of Rolf Mengele, the son of Joseph Mengele, and that Mr. Rosak has knowledge. One Israeli agent, according to Mr. Rosak, and we had this on the air last week or the week before, said that I will tell you what the world must know. Dr. Mengele is alive. He's very sick and has cancer, but he's alive. The agent, identified as Motti, M-O-T-T-I, of the Mossad, took pictures of Joseph Mengele in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, in June of 1980. The government didn't change hands for another year in Bolivia. This was the height of the Klaus Barbie CIA Mengele drug traffic, which was recognized by our CIA reports in 1979, heavily involved with the cocaine traffic. And I said now they would have to officially bury Mengele when the CIA was making the connections of the cocaine. Mengele was in Santa Cruz, and they took pictures. Well, if the Mossad took pictures of Joseph Mengele, and Mr. Boylan was sitting with Mengele at a given time, and these various agents have used this information to pursue the case, why would they put that time and energy? The Mossad could easily have found that the family wasn't corresponding or communicating, or that there were no bank accounts in Switzerland. And as I said before last week or the week before, when Mr. Strauss from Bavaria went to Israel in 1984, he was asked by the Mossad, did you put money into the Swiss bank of Joseph Mengele? If the Mossad asked about a Swiss bank in 1984 and asked Mr. Strauss, Helmut Strauss, the strong Nazi from Bavaria, about that, they certainly don't believe that Mengele is dead. This story that goes on, this is from The Heritage, a Jewish newspaper in Los Angeles, a wire service from Israel. Mossad reported that Mengele was seen after Bolivia, after 1980, in Paraguay, Uruguay, Argentina, and that he is now living in Paraguay, according to Mahdi's statements, and those were quoted in the German newspaper. Now, this was June the 21st. There is no medical or physical evidence that identifies the exhumed body of Mengele, according to intelligence and other technicians. The only person willing to go on record that the body is Mengele's are his son, Rolf, and Romeo Tuma, a Brazilian police chief who is a son of Syrian immigrants. And we'll go in more into Tuma, and I did a little bit in the past few weeks, and the link down to Sao Paulo, Brazil, the deal that Wiesenthal cut. I don't have time to do even a fraction of what I have here that I want to share with you, but I'm purposely going slowly. Another article out of the New York Times, this was June 15th, the week before the conclusions. Nazi hunter believes Mengele is still alive. Tuvia Friedan, F-R-I-E-D-A-N, a renowned Nazi hunter who helped war criminal Eichmann to trial, expressed skepticism, that the corpse exhumed from the Brazilian cemetery was Mengele. I believe he is still alive. According to Friedman, the advanced state of decomposition indicates that the corpse was buried before 1979, when Mengele is said to have drowned. This is not the body of Mengele, because such a body would have to be in a grave for 20 years. That would make it 1959 that this body was in the grave. Now, in 1961, Mrs. Gerhardt was buried in the grave. I mentioned her last week with the hip story and the Wiesenthal connections to the hip. Mrs. Wolfgang Gerhardt's mother, Frederica, was put in a grave with a broken hip. Well, there's not much difference, I suppose, between 59 and 61, when the grandchildren said that the grave of Joseph Mengele was the same as their grandmother's, even though when they dug it up, they claimed it wasn't. But it could have been that they used that old lady's bones. Who knows what these stones were over the grave, or if anybody knew where the stone was, and just put one over there, and that was actually where she was buried. Friedman said reports that Mengele broke a hip before leaving Germany are false, and it's the Wiesenthal Center that they were true. Brazilian authorities examining the bones and teeth found in the grave are said to have detected signs of a fractured pelvis. Now, as again, it's the Wiesenthals that are saying, even though they sent the hip and the pictures didn't match, they went on, Simon Wiesenthal, particularly the next day, and said, I helped supply the information of the hip, and yet the physical evidence didn't match, and even the investigators, he was willing to do it and take credit for it, as he tried to take credit for Mr. Stengel and Adolf Eichmann, and now he wants credit for this. Citing a document he said was found in Mengele's SS file in Berlin, Friedman said in a 1943 court report of a motorcycle accident involving Mengele, there was no medical reference to a broken hip at all. The SS, I use the word hip, but it in the report it says a broken pelvis. And Mr. Friedman and Rabbi Mark H. Tannenbaum, T-A-N-E-N-B-A-U-M, of the American Jewish Committee, noted the evidence found in Brazil contradicts reports that place Mengele in Paraguay. According to new accounts, he never left Brazil. Either the international intelligence community has been lying about Mengele's whereabouts for 18 years, rather, or this is a gigantic hoax on the international community, especially the Jewish community. Now, and finally, I don't think I have too much time to go into it. There were reports that when this body was dug up, the body was mutilated. The June 18th report from Miami Herald, sent to me thanks to David Miller, a great researcher, Sao Paulo, Brazil, the body suspected to be Joseph Mengele was deformed. The cavity, the cadaver may have been deformed, and they said that it came from outside forces, that there was accelerated erosion of the skeletal remains, and they're not sure how they got there. I might have mentioned this to you before. They said the head isn't normal. When the bones were unearthed, they were broken, including the facial bones, and they couldn't figure out about the condition of the head. Another story, June 18th, skull bones in Brazil found damage. There was a hole in the head, and it looked like there was an abrasion on the top of the head, a hit on the face, unusual deterioration of the bones. including the face. Some facial bones were in poor condition, a small hole found under the left eye and the skull. Well, is it any wonder, given the track record of the police chief there, Mr. Toma, Romeo Toma, who was in charge of the death squads, I've mentioned him before, in charge of torturing, extracting information out of people, because Toma is to work again with Simon Wiesenthal later. So it's important to know that while all of the changes of the body were being described, the case was getting closed. Now, one day before the case was closed officially, it came at about 2 in the morning on the 21st, of June 19, 1985, San Francisco Chronicle has a wire service, UPI. Experts need more records to identify the Mengele bones. I'll have to go into this because it's a good point to leave off. I've got to go back to it later. The Wiesenthal Center are offering what may have been a fractured pelvis, picture of that pelvic area. Again, because 24 hours before the case is to be over, they said, we don't have enough records to identify the bones. So what happened in 24 hours that Simon Wiesenthal became 99.9% sure when down there they were saying, help us, we don't have the information. I have to quit now, the time is over. But in next week, we'll begin with that article because it's important to the key of Simon Wiesenthal, then get back to the biography of Simon Wiesenthal and where he was during the war years and after. This is Mae Bressel from World Watchers. I'm going to continue with this next week.